Great to welcome Sanjeev back to UniWider, and thanks Sanjeev for dropping by, because I know you have a very busy schedule here. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Kunal, for that kind introduction, and I'm very glad not only to see you, but to see Tony Addison and to have seen Lorraine Taivanen and so many other people who I've long associated with WIDER. And indeed, I used to come here quite often, and so much so that I am scratching my head a little bit trying to recall the last, exactly when was the last occasion that I had come here, but it certainly wasn't very recently. And so it's a great pleasure to be back and to have this occasion. As Kunal mentioned, I am not going to speak about one of the more technical topics, which I am also interested in or working on, the more development economics research, which I have been engaged in, because Kunal thought that there would be interest in the work that I have been doing or had been engaged in about 3 years ago, and which I have been trying to reflect on a little bit, which provided some input into the reform process of what has come to be called the UN Development System. And as Kunal mentioned, the Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed has referred to it as the biggest transformation that the UN development system has ever undergone, that which is currently underway, as a direct result of the process which I was engaged in. The perspective of an academic in these diplomatic processes is, of course, necessarily a different one from those who are directly involved, the political representatives of countries, but also the administrative officials in development agencies. And no doubt my remarks will reflect that in different ways. Perhaps they will allow me to provide some aspects of a distinct viewpoint. I won't call it an objective viewpoint, because I think that's very hard to arrive at here. But certainly they would offer a different viewpoint, one which is a little bit more distanced, I hope, from some of the interests involved, and is able to describe what the different interests are and what the issues are in a different way than the participants who are more directly lobbying for a specific outcome might do. But of course, they might also reflect from the perspective of the political and administrative minded participants in the debate a degree of naivete. Now, that cannot also be discounted. I'm not in the habit of characterizing myself as naive, but I would have to recognize that, again, an academic perspective on the issue, however close, is not necessarily going to have a full view of all of the political constraints which are present. Again, that has a good side and a bad side, perhaps, or a good side and a less good side to it. It allows one to keep in mind the ideals or the ultimate purposes with which the system is tasked, in a way that is not mired in everyday realpolitik and bureaucratic concerns, but on the other hand, it might lead to lack of attention to all of the feasibility issues as some of the other participants see them. Okay, so let me step back in a different direction now and ask the question, what is the UN Development System? Some of you might have heard the phrase, some of you might not have. Broadly speaking, the UN Development System is the set of entities in the United Nations which are concerned with development. There are different ways of defining exactly what that means. And in a paper which I wrote called The UN's Development Function, Time for Renewal, which I sent to Kunal and which he can circulate to you, which was published in the journal called Development of the Society for International Development, there's a footnote which goes into the minutiae of the different ways in which the UN development system can be defined. And even then, of course, it doesn't actually expose all of the issues. It simply points to the fact that there are a number of questions of definition which are involved. But broadly speaking, it's the set of organizations concerned with development, whether what are called in UN jargon operational activities for development or development more generally. And it's a set of 40-plus organizations. And normally, the UN development system is not taken as including the Bretton Woods institutions, even though, in a very broad sense, they are also understood to be part of the UN family. Okay? So these are organizations which all of you are familiar with, concerned with different aspects or sides of the development process. The very fact that there are 40-plus organizations, of course, should cause us to wonder whether and to what extent they work together. Right? And this is an issue which arises in a very concrete sense at the field level, as some of you will know better than others, and no doubt better than me. At the field level, there is the question of to what extent organizations concerned with different issues are coordinating their programs, even when there are very obvious respects in which those programs ought to be coordinated. Just to give one example, and I know that these are not Chatham House rules because we have Facebook Live here, but to give one example which is rather well known, the three Rome-based organizations concerned with food and agriculture are, shall we say, not always thought to be perfectly coordinated, whether at the level of headquarters or at the field level. And these are entities which one might think would coordinate quite well by virtue of all sitting in Rome and all being concerned with a common set of issues in some broad sense related to food and agriculture. And of course, the problem becomes still larger when one includes other kinds of concerns which, of course, have causal interconnections of various kinds, for example, between health and education, or agriculture and health, and so on and so forth. So it's very natural to ask the question, to what extent do these organizations coordinate or cooperate in a meaningful way, and to what extent are perhaps their efforts less successful than they could be by virtue of a lack thereof. Now, all of you know that to call for more coordination is motherhood and apple pie, so to speak, in UN reports and evaluations. There's even, and some of you might actually have encountered this, the occasional reference, and it's only partially a joke, to the coordination of coordination. So for me to say that there's a lack of coordination is not perhaps to say very much, or a lack of adequate coordination. That's practically axiomatic, that coordination, the level of coordination is never adequate. But I think that there's a very real problem on the ground which is perceived, and this has led to various efforts in the past, even before the 2030 Agenda came on the scene. For instance, to create what was called the UNDAF, the UN Development Assistance Framework for a given country, in which the different UN organizations in the country would subscribe to, or at least attempt to articulate, a common program as to what it is that their development assistance efforts in the program country concerned were meant to do. So that there was at least an intellectual effort to, in some way, bring these different activities together. Of course, very often such a document did read like a laundry list, the extent of actual interweaving of the concerns and the plans was perhaps questionable. And this reflected in part the fact that the UN resident coordinator in a country, the individual meant to represent the United Nations as a whole in a country, was somewhat powerless. And in fact, and this came to our attention as members of the independent team of advisors on the, had an awfully long bureaucratic name, long-term positioning of the UN development system in support of the 2030 Agenda for Development or something of that kind. One of the things that came to our attention was that the UN resident coordinator very often didn't have a single cent to spend on, for example, coffee for a meeting to which she or he would invite other heads of UN entities in the country. Right? So there was no provision for that. And as a matter of practical correlation, the UN resident coordinator ended up being almost always a UNDP, or most often, I should say, a UNDP staff member, and UNDP played the role, the UN Development Program played the role of coordinating the UN resident coordinator system. There we have it, coordination of coordination. And that was a role which UNDP, to some extent, jealously guarded because it gave it rationale, which UNDP has been in search of throughout its existence, arguably, and certainly at times it has served very valuable functions. But at the field level, especially because UNDP is a has a multi-sectoral mandate, it has often been obscure exactly what UNDP's special advantage or value addition was meant to be. And so having this resident coordinator function was something that was important to it as an organization. Obversely, the other entities were not terribly happy to recognize the authority of the UN resident coordinator. So even though there might have been an abstract recognition that this person is a first among equals, primus inter pares, that did not necessarily translate into any type of real, let us say, depth of interaction. And it certainly didn't translate in general into what one might think of at one extreme as being a chain of command. There's nothing like that in the United Nations system. And maybe it's a good thing that there isn't such a extreme and hierarchical model. But there isn't even a pale shadow of that, and hasn't been, in fact. So this led, even before, again, the articulation of the 2030 Agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, to concerns. The UNDAF was one response. And another response was the so-called Delivering as One initiative, which has been much hyped, much praised, as an important initiative for the coordination of UN development activities within countries, but also for its simplification, for their simplification, and for achieving cost reductions and managerial efficiencies. Delivering as One was meant to reduce duplication in various respects, for example, by bringing about common procurement and back office functions, as well as to allow for common resources to be made available, for instance, UN vehicles, UN offices, and the like. The Delivering as One initiative took quite a long time to agree upon. There was much resistance, I understand. I was not privy to that came about at an earlier stage than my involvement. But there was much discussion among UN entities as to how exactly that was to be achieved. And it turned out there were innumerable obstacles. For instance, such simple questions as what is the logo which is to be employed when UN entities have a shared office or a shared vehicle or other resource became objects of disputation, from what I understand. So the process of actually implementing these managerial efficiencies was very extended and only moderately successful, I think it's fair to say, according to the evaluation which was done, formally done, as well as the other references in the official record. Okay. So it's in this context that when the 2030 Agenda was promulgated, shall we say, with, in some sense, quite ambitious, at least as compared to the Millennium Development Goals, objectives of various kinds, the question was asked, are the UN development-oriented entities funds programs and agencies fit for purpose in the sense of being able effectively to deliver on this agenda. Not that it's an agenda meant to be delivered by them, because ultimately it's a commitment of countries. But it is quite natural to ask, was quite natural to ask the question, is this set of organizations, this ensemble of organizations, entities, well suited or not to fostering the fulfillment of the agenda? Now, this is where the politics come in. There is no governance system that applies in common to all of these entities. They have their own boards. It is only at a very abstract level that such a thing might be said to exist, and this is that they report, most of them, to the ECOSOC, the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, or they are considered to be in some sense subordinate to the Economic and Social Council. Now, the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, as the United Nations itself, is a represents a wide variety of countries with a wide variety of different interests and ideas with respect to development. So bringing about any type of meaningful and substantive supervision of these entities might be imagined to be something difficult to do in such a context. And indeed, by and large, the ECOSOC had exercised very weak supervision with respect to the UN development system. It was in that context that they originated the idea of, again, more UN jargon, which, as a relative outsider, I myself most of the time get wrong, the QCPR, Quadrennial Comprehensive Policy Review, which was meant to be a periodic effort by the ECOSOC taken as a whole to assess what the UN development system was doing right or wrong and how it could be, how its activities could be enhanced. One of the major fissures, obviously, within the ECOSOC is in the United Nations as a whole, is between the so-called program countries in which development activities are undertaken by the United Nations, broadly speaking, the developing countries, and the donor countries. And one of the major issues, as one might imagine, as you are indeed all aware, concerns money. Whether or not the existing flows are adequate, and it should simply be a matter of managerial efficiencies being found that is discussed, or whether additional resources are needed. Right? So this is one of the major fault lines. And there are other related fault lines. It turns out, for example, that broadly speaking, there was a perception on the part of the G77 plus China, the developing countries in the United Nations, that the donor countries had been gaining influence in some sense with respect to the development activities of the UN by changing the composition of the resources which were made available to the organizations from so-called core contributions to non-core contributions. The difference being that the core contributions are not discretionary, and the non-core contributions are ones which are tied to specific purposes which the donor wishes to fund and are provided on a voluntary basis, as a rough distinction at any rate. By their very nature, then, non-core contributions allow the donor to exercise more influence because they are targeted towards specific programs. Now, if you look at the of interest to the donor and activities, if you look at the composition of revenues of the entities, you'll see a very rapid increase. I don't have the figures in front of me, but again, you'll find relevant footnotes in the paper, and they're easily found. the information is easily found, you'll find a very big and rapid shift in composition in favor of non-core contributions, at the same time that the overall resources of the UN development system have also been, to be fair, increasing. So there is an increase that has taken place, but a very large shift in composition that has also taken place, to the extent that the majority of the expenditures are now in the non-core category. So this was another major fault line. A third fault line concerned, broadly speaking, the development versus humanitarian expenditure divide, humanitarian activities divide, with there being a perception that, again, development activities were of less interest to donors, or had become, as compared to humanitarian activities, as revealed in part in the changing proportions of resources devoted to these, and there being, of course, a larger discretionary component in funding of humanitarian activities, because by their very nature they arise in response to exigencies of various sorts. Now, my understanding is that within the ECOSOC it was very difficult to come to any agreement on what type of reform of the governance structures of the system was desirable or attainable as a result of these fault lines, among others, and that's why a group of independent persons was asked to provide input, of which I was one. One of the very interesting aspects of the experience for me was the realization that the system really lacks data on itself. It produces reams of data about specific things, but on the other hand, if one wants the answer to sometimes rather simple questions, it turns out that the system as a whole doesn't have that information about itself. So very often the exercise was handicapped by the lack of that kind of managerially relevant data, which ought to be available to and play a role in governance decisions. But nevertheless, over a very short period of time, we presented some proposals. We were given only a very short period of time, and I think the time was very seriously inadequate. But nevertheless, some proposals were made, and one of the proposals that was made was that the UN resident coordinators should be made directly responsible to the Secretary General and should be provided with funds to support their activities so as to bring about a more meaningful coordination at the field level, and indeed at every level. This was accepted, and since that recommendation was made and was broadly accepted, quite a lot has happened to bring it about, including some very specific financing mechanisms. One of them, interestingly, is a levy. This came about, or at least I became aware of it after this paper which I published, and so it's not mentioned there, a levy on non-core contributions of 1%. So any country that makes a non-core contribution to a UN entity is, in principle, required to provide 1%, which will go toward the exercise of these common functions of the resident coordinator system. But that's not the sole means by which it's meant to be financed. In addition, there are other mechanisms such as pledges, which are of a voluntary nature, but which are meant to be advertised so that all can see which countries have made pledges and which haven't toward the support of the resident coordinator system. And indeed, there's a website where you can actually go and see exactly what has been done. But there were other aspects which were, let us say, less managerial in nature, which I think were not taken up. And I don't want to go on at length because I know we have only 1 hour. But let me say a bit about this. And this speaks to the role of UNU wider, among other things. And is something that's quite close to my heart and plays a very central role in the paper which I published, which again Kunal can circulate to you if it is of interest. I argue in the paper, and I think this was to some extent inchoate in my earlier reflections on this when I was actually participating in the independent team of advisors, that the United Nations has a very particular and special role in the broader universe of development actors. And I think that even, to be a bit self-critical, even as we produced our recommendations, we were not sufficiently aware of this. And one of the drumbeats, so to speak, that kept emerging, including from UN staff, was that there are other other development actors which are more effective than we are, and we should simply cede the ground to them. There's no reason for us to do everything that they do. We should cede the ground wherever there are other actors which are more effective than us, and there might be very little that's left in the end for the United Nations to do. We're dwarfed by them in any case, but we're also less effective. Now, I certainly think that there can be an argument, there is certainly an argument, which I would also endorse, for some restructuring of that kind. For instance, there are countries in which the United Nations is heavily involved in very operational activities for development. Operational activities for development is an actual category within UNEs, but what I have in mind here to refer to is that UN entities are executing field-level projects, right? They are doing so oftentimes because money has been made available to them to do so, right? And whether it makes sense for the United Nations, in one or another of its manifestations, to be sinking bore wells to provide drinking water, right, or whether it should cede that ground to another actor is, I think, a very good question. On the other hand, there are lots of things which the UN is uniquely suited to do, and I'm going to give you five reasons very quickly, and I will end in 5 to 7 minutes, as to why the United Nations is uniquely suited to do certain things. It has the following characteristics, which I think are very pertinent. First, it's perceived as a largely neutral body, okay, in that it is seen as not systematically or strongly favoring particular national interests, at least when it comes to development programs, at least generally. There are exceptions, but generally that's the case. Second, it's a body that reflects a role for almost all countries as constituent elements, and thus is perceived to speak in a universal voice. Not exactly the same thing as the first. Neutrality versus universality. Third, it is perceived as governed by a democratic ethos, insofar as the countries that make it up all have representation in decision-making. Again, subtly different, though closely related. Fourth, it has diverse concerns and objectives, including political, social, cultural, and economic elements. And as a result, it does not uniformly prioritize objectives of a particular kind, as entities with more narrowly economic objectives, for example, the Bretton Woods institutions, might be perceived as doing. And fifth, it is perceived as having a progressive mission aiming to create a better world and not merely to stabilize or to maintain prevailing conditions. And again, this is something which perhaps is not always perceived in every situation, but there are many, for the most part, I think this is the way it is perceived. Now, some of these considerations have both, as a consequence, a good side and a bad side. And an example I would give of that is that the other side of the perception of neutrality or of universality or of being democratic in nature is the culture of diplomacy, which is one of the main reasons for the sclerosis, the ineffectuality of the United Nations in many situations, because it is oftentimes sufficient for one country to register a strong objection in order for the United Nations to give way to that objection and to, for example, withdraw from a whole area of activity. That's not always the case, but it can be the case because of the sensitivity to the views of specific countries, which is built in to the diplomatic culture, which the United Nations in many ways embodies. Right? So I argue that we ought to recognize that there are these particular traits which make the United Nations well-suited for certain purposes. But on the other hand, we also have to have institutional mechanisms that combat some of the weaknesses that arise as a result. We do need stronger governance systems, and there could be different ways to achieve that. One of the ways which we proposed and which I would like to see brought about, though perhaps it's not surprising, perhaps not surprisingly, this has been of less interest in the political discussion, is to bring in representatives to the boards who are not representatives of countries, but who are independent experts of various kinds, right? So as to help to mute the role of the diplomatic culture in governance. That would be one of many possible initiatives, right? We need to have a much more rigorous process of scrutinizing individual entities to see how well they have done with respect to particular objectives and to provide very concrete managerial guidance, including perhaps to recommend closure, something which has rarely, if ever, been done in the United Nations system. Right? Again, because of this overwhelming culture of diplomacy and the bureaucratic power of insiders who wish to reproduce themselves. I can mention, I think, that the United Nations development program was not entirely pleased at the reform of the resident coordinator function, because it moved it from effectively being linked to UNDP to the Secretary General's office. But nevertheless, that happened, right? So there are instances where it is possible to overcome that kind of resistance, and one needs stronger built-in mechanisms of various kinds to do that. The quality of evaluation in the UN system is at the moment, I think, not adequate to bring that about. There are many other issues that I could mention, but let me just, for want of time, and because I'd rather have discussion, make one last point, which is that I think that the portfolio of activities of the UN development-related organizations can be shifted toward ones which are, so to speak, more upstream, in the sense that they have more of the potential to shape ideas and policies. That is, it seems to me, where there is the greatest potential for the UN development system to have an impact. And indeed, if one looks back at the history of the United Nations, one sees, as Richard Jolly showed in his UN Intellectual History Project, done with collaborators, among others, there's been a history of excellent contributions by the United Nations to ideas about development strategy and policy. But in recent years, I think it's plausible to argue, there has been a withering of this function, a lessening of in-house intellectual capacity in many of the organizations, perhaps also a lessening of the commitment of donors to this type of work, which is seen as being hard to justify to their publics, but which is nevertheless extremely important. And obviously UNUWIDER is an example of an organization which has such a role. But it's not the only example of how that upstream function can be influenced. One of the other examples which I give in the paper is that in the 1990s, in particular, the UN was very closely associated with a number of international conferences on various issues, which brought together what we might call a democratic rabble of voices from around the world. Right? And these voices were not always comfortable to listen to for everyone concerned, but they brought about something like a global democratic moment in which, on specific issues, for instance, gender, Beijing conference, or many other issues, a plurality of voices were heard. Maybe not enough voices were still heard. Maybe in that case or in other cases, some of the conservative voices should have been heard more. All of that's arguable. But I think it was a very valuable function that the United Nations played to create a stage for those kinds of discussions to take place. So it's not just a question of the development economists coming to a place such as WIDA and having an opportunity to formulate ideas and make bold initiatives, which I think is very important, right, which could influence the policy debate. I think in that connection of Lal Jayawardena, the first director of WIDA, and I recall meeting him here in 1991, and Lal Jayawardena had floated a proposal at that time. I think it was actually a UNU WIDA working paper for the recycling of Japanese surpluses. At that time, it wasn't Chinese; it was Japanese surpluses which were being discussed, and not German surpluses either. The recycling of Japanese surpluses to benefit the developing countries. So he had a proposal of a specific mechanism through which that could be done. That's an example of a bold contribution to the development debate coming from the United Nations. Now, that wasn't taken up as a different issue, but I think that to have various ideas of that kind emerging from institutions such as this one, and then to be discussed, to be taken apart, to be reflected upon as to whether they're good ideas or not, whether they're feasible or not, that's an important contribution of entities such as this, and that is very much what should be strengthened, right? Quite apart from the other things that the United Nations can do, which only it can do, such as bringing about these global democratic moments in which there is a polyphony or a plurality of voices which emerges. So let me stop there. I think I've already gone on for more than was allotted to me, and I look forward to any questions, comments, criticisms, and discussion. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thanks, Ajay. So we have about 20 minutes, actually, so that's not too bad. Should we take 3 questions at a time? Sure. That's okay. So who wants to go first? Thank you. It was very insightful and very frank, I have to say. I just went off the event, the form process. Who would like to ask the first question? Tony, yes, indeed.
I mean, on the coordination issue, also in the delivery of assistance to countries, you know, you can argue for more coordination. But in the intellectual sphere, where you finished off, you could actually argue for less coordination, in the sense that you could say that one of the strengths of the UN system has been it's actually allowed space for mavericks. So in some ways, you know, if it had been better organised, it might have actually tried to kill off the mavericks. But because it couldn't do that, there's been a space for those kind of wider perspectives. At the intellectual level, you know, as you've said, there's an opportunity for many different voices. And it's strange, isn't it, this cleavage, as you said at the beginning, the cleavage between the World Bank and the IMF, which are formerly part of the UN system, but which are not. And, you know, the bank has financial powers because it can raise funding on the bond market that, you know, just isn't available to UN agencies. So it has a sort of independence of operation. It's not necessarily been as effective as some of the UN agencies. If you go right back to the kind of foundation of the UN system in the mid-1940s in the context of the Second World War, I don't think you'd have thought, the founders certainly of the system would not have expected there to be such a big cleavage between sort of UN diplomacy side, the humanitarian side, and the World Bank, the Bretton Woods institutions. I don't think they had that conception. So I was wondering, sort of, here's the question, you know, whether they can ever be brought together again, or whether the sort of cultural styles now of the Bretton Woods organisations are so different to the UN system that there will never be a kind of return or development of consistency.
I think you might want to take the question from Tony.
Okay. Sure, thank you. Thanks, Tony, for that as usual, excellent question. Look, I think that you're absolutely right, right? That there is such a thing as excessive coordination or efforts at coordination, which could have a counterproductive consequence. Right? It could be another source of sclerotic structure. And certainly in the world of ideas, as you rightly underline, there has to be a room for 100 flowers to bloom. And it's precisely in that way that good ideas are found to be good. They contest with one another. They are refined in the process of that contestation. And very often, it is healthy to have opposing ideas emerging even from within the same organization, right? Let alone from across different organizations and the broader universe in which the debate is taking place. So I would completely agree with you on that. And in fact, I would say that you know, my own sensibility in this regard veers a bit more toward the anarchistic end of the spectrum in terms of how I think about intellectual life and what's a good ecology for generating ideas and taking up ideas, right? And I think we should have more of that than we do, even within the United Nations and even within specific organizations. And one of the consequences of the withering of the intellectual capabilities of specific entities, which I mentioned, has been that, you know, very often they find it difficult to articulate a single view, let alone multiple views, right? And one, of course, would like to see these multiple views contesting and to have, indeed, space for mavericks within the organizations. And again, I think if you look at Jolly's intellectual history of the United Nations, Jolly et al., you would find that many of them were mavericks of various kinds, notwithstanding the fact that they later on gained considerable acclaim. Now, as far as your question as to whether the Bretton Woods institutions and the UN can be brought together again, I think that there are structural reasons why that might be difficult, as you point out, having to do with the imperatives that the Bretton Woods institutions have historically furthered and been committed to, in some sense, their systemic functions, which are different from those of the United Nations, and they have a different governance arrangements, much stronger governance arrangements, actually, one could argue, in some ways, but different. It's interesting that, you know, even the room for employing those governance arrangements to bring countries together, to bring the different organizations together in terms of their programs, has not always been adequately exploited. You can see representatives of the same country expressing very different views sometimes on the Bretton Woods boards and on UN boards. So there's probably, in part, an effect of an institutional culture, which is seen as dividing these entities up in such a way that certain organizations have certain kinds of goals and other organizations have other kinds of goals. But that having been said, I think we do see a coalescence. I remember Jim Wolfensohn's, at least moments of coalescence, right? There are and possibilities of it. Jim Wolfensohn's comprehensive framework for development, I think that's what it was called, wasn't it? Comprehensive approach or framework, whatever it was. The comprehensive approach to development.
Comprehensive development framework.
Thank you. Comprehensive development framework. Now, the comprehensive development framework had everything in it that any representative of the UN world, right, could possibly have wanted. You know, I saw very little to object to in the comprehensive development framework. Certainly, the World Bank didn't look like the boogeyman of structural adjustment in the comprehensive development framework. So it began to certainly to articulate, to express ideas that were much more broad-ranging. And of course, Amartya Sen was very heavily involved with Jim Wolfensohn in producing that. More recently, not only has the IMF Research Department, as you know, produced a number of very well-received and well-argued papers on the topic of inequality, in which the argument has been that inequality is potentially quite damaging to sustained prosperity. But that has influenced the IMF's operational work. Recently, just I think a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, Christine Lagarde made a declaration to the effect that the IMF would be taking this on board in its operational work. So I think these are hopeful moments. And I certainly, while recognizing the structural divide which you point to, would also want to not be entirely without hope about the possibility of bridging that divide.
Beyond in chance.
Actually, it's a follow-up question to Tony and then to your answer, but
yes.
Actually taking it from the other side, I would also say that World Bank and maybe also IMF, they also confronted with what's our role nowadays in this world. And although the funding systems have not changed, what you already raised with gender and inequality, now kind of moving in onto their agenda as well, isn't that at least on the surface taking away some of the uniqueness of the five characteristics that you assigned to the UN system? And what does it mean that just last week, maybe you were actually alluding to that, just IMF released this, how do we go about in our adjustment programs and how do we take account of social protection all of a sudden? And which I think most of us are probably very happy about, this change of mind happening. Yet, it also means the haggling over topics, inequality, gender, just being two, that are not only economic, right? Even if they justify it to the economic demos, I think it goes beyond that. What does that then mean to the uniqueness of the UN system to address certain challenges?
Well, I think that one shouldn't approach these issues as if there's a turf war of any kind. I think that one should, as you say, welcome the fact that the IMF has been changing its operational protocols and its intellectual view in a very considerable way, in particular on social protection. We couldn't have imagined that 20 years ago when Andrea Cornia edited this book called Inequality, Growth, and Poverty in an Era of Liberalization and Globalization. We couldn't have imagined, I don't think, that the IMF would build into its conditionalities the demand for social expenditures to be protected, right? So that is a change. That having been said, the IMF still has ultimately the goals that it has, right? And so there are going to be on the margin certain trade-offs that it might make which might be different. It might be willing to hit that lower threshold, right, as long as the side constraint is maintained. So the differences might become more subtle, right, than they were previously. And there may also be counter-revolutions, so to speak. I don't think, history is over in this respect. And as the IMF moves seemingly more leftward in some of these respects, there may be other ways in which some of the systemic imperatives that the IMF seemed to be representing in the past will be expressed. So, I think the Eurozone crisis is a good example of that. In the Eurozone crisis, the IMF, in the Troika, arguably, right, was the entity which was most soft on the debtor countries. Right? It's not that it had a view which was altogether different from the other members of the Troika, but it certainly was willing to sanction a less stringent regime, right? And it had a different analysis which underpinned that. So I think, broadly speaking, that development is to be welcomed, but it's very conditional, very contingent. Perhaps we'll have to see what happens. And similarly, on the issues that you mentioned, an awareness of gender, for instance, could mean many things, right? When Larry Summers was the chief economist of the World Bank, one of his flagship research efforts was a paper called Investing in All the People, which was an argument for investing in girls and women's education and health on the ground that it would lead to good economic outcomes. And that is certainly a reason to do it, right? But as Amartya Sen pointed out in response to that and other such arguments that have been made in the past. It's certainly not the only reason to do it. And if it were the main reason to do it too, that would be probably rather flawed. So I think that the distinctions might be a little bit more subtle than they were, at least for the moment.
Charles?
Yeah, thank you very much. I used to work in UNCTAD.
Right.
And so what you say, you know, resonates very strongly with some of my kind of professional experiences there. I have a comment on your list of five things the UN is suited to do. And I think, you know, from my experience in UNCTAD, I think the most important thing was that we were able to think globally. And I feel, you know, that this, you know, this, when you said the IMF moving leftwards, I'm not sure whether that's a correct summary of what's going on. What the pressures in UNCTAD were always to get us out of thinking globally and shift us to the national level. And one of the devices to do this, as you correctly put your finger on, is this core versus non-core activities. Because this donor money going into an organization creates all kinds of incentives, micro-incentives for people who see their, you know, professional career being stuck in the backwater of commodities or moving forward into some area which the donors are interested in. And so what you see is that the incentive structures are trying to get you out of thinking globally. But in fact, what an organization like UNCTAD could do, and what an organization like FAO could do, what an organization like ILO, they could think globally. And what one saw when one went to World Bank meetings is that they couldn't think globally. They weren't thinking globally, although they would produce some of these reports like Global Economic Prospects, but there were things like the World Development Report. They would put a chapter at the end. If they were looking at inequality, they would put a chapter at the end on the global situation. So anyway, I think the thinking globally is very important, and the source for that is data. These organizations have data. So WIDA has its inequality data sets. Now, these data sets enable you to think globally. And anyway, so that's my comment. But I suppose the question I'd like to ask is you talk about this lessening of in-house intellectual capacity within the UN system. Do you see any? What are the forces behind that? What is necessary to reverse the lessening of in-house intellectual capacity? Because that seems to be kind of key to the situation.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you for that very interesting question. I think that you're quite right that the UN is better poised to think globally than other entities, and that probably ought to have been in my list of reasons that the UN is different. But as you also, I think, implicitly pointed out in your response, the Bretton Woods institutions too, in principle, have a global mandate. And I think you argued that, for the most part, they don't think globally, but again, there may be moments where one can see that they do. So, for example, recently, as you know, the IMF has been, for the first time, taking on issues of systemic stability, which I believe it was given a bit of a push to do by the G20. And in doing so, it is discussing the implications of the US-China imbalance, for instance, for global systemic financial stability. That type of concern, which of course could also be the concern of DESA in the UN Secretariat or UNCTAD or another such entity, it seems to me, is from time to time evinced, also in the Bretton Woods institutions, and perhaps is increasingly being evinced in the IMF because of this development and other such developments, perhaps in the World Bank too, on occasion. If we think about climate change, for instance, there are moments where I think one can see some recognition that there are really global and systemic issues which need attention. Right? So that may not be a UN versus Bretton Woods institutions contrast, but it certainly is a contrast, entirely at least, but it certainly is a contrast between the organizations, the multilateral organizations that have global reach and concern as a part of their mandates, and the bilateral organizations. And bilateral organizations, which very often have a powerful field presence and may indeed be the most influential actors in particular countries, may not be very good at taking account of the interdependencies that exist even within that country, across different thematic areas in which they are operating and others are operating, for instance, let alone between countries in a region or between countries globally and regions globally. So I think that's an excellent point, and I simply take it on and I embrace it. And I should just make one minor correction, which is that I think I referred to the IMF seemingly moving leftward, because I agree. Whether we should characterize it that way is very much a question mark. The question you asked finally was... I'm sorry, I can't read my own handwriting. Could you just give me a word to jog my memory?
The question, how can one rebuild this intellectual capacity? What is the way to do that?
Exactly. I don't have a simple answer. In the recommendations that we made in the independent team of advisors, something that I very much tried to insert in there was the idea that the UN has a special advantage in and imperative to provide leadership in terms of ideas, and that entities such as UNU Wider and many other institutions within the UN universe, which have some capacity to do that, should be recognized as having that role and be bolstered. Now, how does one get the donors to pay heed to that? I'm not sure that there's any straightforward answer to that. I think that the donors, I do think, and maybe I'm wrong here, but my impression is that the donors think that this is a hard sell to their publics. But then the donors think almost everything is a hard sell to their publics, which is why one sees that aid flows have been stagnating, essentially. And perhaps there's no more clear-cut measure of the enormous gap between rhetoric and reality than the way in which the SDG agenda has ostensibly committed countries to a variety of things, some of which are quite ambitious, and which include increased aid flows, when actual aid flows have stagnated or arguably even shrunk when you strip away certain kinds of expenditures which have been recently added on to the classification of what counts as aid, as you know, such as, for example, in-country expenditures on refugee and resettlement programs. When you take those out, then aid flows appear to quite possibly have decreased. So I think that that there has to be a different understanding of what matters in development. It's not just about sinking those tube wells, that might be an important thing to do, but it's about understanding how to deal with the global drinking water crisis, which is emerging, right? The United Nations spends very little on research as compared with the Bretton Woods institutions. And of course, people, including my friends in the World Bank's research department, complain that they don't have the level of prestige that some of their colleagues do, or the level of attention. They don't get the resources that they want. In fact, they recently had, I believe, a decrease in their budget, which, of course, one can be sympathetic to. But at the same time, I think there's a different recognition of the role of ideas. There's a recognition that development ideas do flow downstream, and they do shape the debate in ways that really matter in the end. So we have to make that case, I would say.
Any final questions? There's one more question I think we have time for. I had a question on the resident coordinated reforms.
Yes.
I mean, since I have been to several of these countries where we see the situation on the ground, it's all clear to me why was it necessary at this point to try and reform the resident coordinated system. As you said, a situation where they don't have the funds, they resident coordinated don't have funds, situation where the UNDP and many places have obviously has been quite unhappy with the way that this has happened. In many places where they don't even have resident coordinators in place, they still haven't found people to play this role. When one can argue when the SDG agenda, 11 years now, 2030, if you get the most recent report on where we are on the SDG agenda, it's shocking. Shocking, really. We are far away from even reaching most of the milestones or indicators that are in the SDG goals, right? So was it really necessary to do this? Was it just a simply tokenistic reform that had to be done to show there was going to be reform, when really the substantial issue that had to be looked at was never really addressed? I still don't see the rationale behind why these particular reforms have happened, which is where most of the energies of the reform process has been concentrated.
Yes. So much as I spent most of my time describing the reform that you are questioning, I would agree with you, you know, that it's not at all obvious that this is the most important thing to have done. I think, and here let me be a little bit candid as well, I think that there was a strong agenda coming out of certain countries to achieve managerial reforms in the UN development system from the first, and that was part of what motivated the entire ECOSOC exercise. And I won't name the particular countries, but let us say that the countries with that agenda made sure to influence the process in different ways, constructively, but nevertheless directionally. And so what emerged from it was very much this idea, right? That there could be potential efficiencies, but also increases in effectiveness by changing the structure of the field level representation of the United Nations and the way in which United Nations entities work together. But is that a first order issue? Is it even the issue that one is it even one of the issues that one would think of in the list of the top 10 things that should be attended to in order to make the United Nations system more effective in helping to support the achievement of the SDGs? I don't know, right? I mean, that would have been, I think, a very sensible question to ask. I gave one example of something that we were simply not permitted to discuss, which is very important, which is the question of what should be the relation between humanitarian and development activities. That was not in our brief, and we were very clearly told that it was not in our brief. So there are probably lots of other issues that should be on the agenda. And again, the lack of resources is something which must be attended to. Financing for Development conferences and others have found that the quantity of resources necessary to achieve the SDGs is an order of magnitude greater than what is being provided. And when that is recognized, then, of course, people next think that the private sector can somehow be tapped. But there's a certain wooliness, a certain obscurantism, I think, about how exactly the private sector is supposed to fill that gap. Because, after all, the private sector might be expected to do certain things, such as build toll roads, toll highways, but not to do other things, such as build rural roads. So how it is that that this gap is to be plugged is something about which I think we have our collective heads in the sand. And one of the things I argue in our paper is that the United Nations should move from being less of a scorekeeper to being more of a truth teller. And this is an example of where it has to be a truth teller. It has to say, look, there is a gap, and it's not just a gap, it's a yawning gap. And this comes from, in some sense, the total failure of your collective efforts to match up to your stated collective intentions, right? And let's not be diplomatic about this. It's not a matter of pointing fingers at individuals, it's a matter of seeing that there's a systemic failure taking place, right? Which needs attention, and not just through raising resources, but through all the other means as well that can be mobilized to do that, right? Maybe just as now we have a mechanism for taking 1% of non-core expenditures and transferring it to a particular purpose, right? The support of the UN Resident Coordinator System. maybe we should have something similar with respect to certain private sector activities. Perhaps every toll road, toll highway that's constructed should also have attached to it a cess, which helps to finance rural roads in the same country through government expenditures or through some other mechanism. That's an idea off the top of my head, right? But how many other ideas are there? Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe that's a bad idea, which we should discard after talking about why it's a bad idea for the next 5 minutes. But the point is not that that's a good idea. The point is that we really need ideas as well as reflection in a very empirical and policy-oriented way upon them in order to plug these gaps.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's very useful. We need to stop here because so I just got to make another presentation on a different thing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.